You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. Could not be helped because we all have complicated lives and lots of stuff to do, but we are back to talk about Twin Peaks episode 9, 10, and 11. So apologies for any frustration for you guys who are just like, just get to episode 11 already! We're going to do as we always do, going straight through these things one at a time by reading out the Wikipedia synopsises of each episode, some of which I've added a little bit too, just because I was like, hey, you know, that was pertinent enough. Yeah. Before we start, I'm Chris.
I'm Ian.
I'm Betty.
And I'm Scott.
And here we go with episode 9. Cooper's doppelganger meets Hutch, Tim Roth, and Chantal, Jennifer Jason Leigh, at a farm. He sends a text to Diane and calls Duncan Todd, Patrick Fischler, to ask if he has done it yet. He orders Warden Murphy's death, mentions a job in Las Vegas, and drives away. Dougie's boss claims Dougie sometimes has episodes due to an old car accident. The Las Vegas police discover no record of Dougie Jones before 1997 and take fingerprints and DNA from his coffee mug. They arrest Ike the Spike, who has just left a phone message for JT. Bobby visits his mother with Sheriff Truman and Hawk to ask about Cooper. She tells them her husband long ago foretold their arrival and gives them a small metal cylinder containing instructions about a location, date, and Cooper's name written twice. The FBI stops in Buckhorn to examine the body with Major Briggs's fingerprints. Tammy questions Hastings, who says he and Ruth visited Briggs in another dimension where he had been hibernating for years and witnessed his beheading as he was saying Cooper's name. Hastings' secretary has been killed in a car explosion and his lawyer arrested for the murder of his wife. Meanwhile, Johnny Horn gets into an accident and Jerry Horn hallucinates his foot is talking to him. At the roadhouse, a junkie called Ella scratches a serious rash. All right, so this was had a lot of odd stuff and some new characters introduced here. Some returns of some characters we weren't sure we were ever going to see again. You know, Mr. C talking to Hutch and Chantal. Glad to see that Roth and Jennifer Jason Leigh in there for sure, who are both slavishly like into Mr. C.
Oh yeah,
like where he's like, you want to fuck my wife?
This is all, I feel like this is all part of this, like, redneck cult of personality he's, like, building around himself of, like, this army of, like, white trash gangsters that he has, like, all in place all around the country.
Yeah. I mean, we've certainly seen some degree of that in the fact that you don't want to fuck up because he doesn't really have a great firing program. There's no benefits or gold watch, just you get killed. as well, he says Warden Murphy yanked in federal prison. Kill him at home, at work, or on the way. I love how so, like, you know what, whatever. Mm-hmm. Just make sure he's dead.
Yeah.
Typical Mr. C. But he also promises him that other assignment, the double header in Vegas, which you can't help but think of the double Briggs, Major Briggs and Ruth, killing from earlier. But the double header in Vegas, we presume one of which would be Dougie.
Yeah.
Or as I'm calling him now, Duper. But I'm not entirely sure who probably Spike would be the other one.
Yeah, either Ike the Spike or maybe the dude from Mulholland Drive.
Red?
Not Red. The casino guy.
Oh,
I am blanking on his name right now.
Of one of the brothers?
No, not the brother. The other guy,
the pit boss.
The pit boss.
You got fired?
No, the dude from the diner from Mulholland Drive, who's in the office in the casino.
Yeah.
Who Mr. C gets in contact with?
Right. So it's possible.
Winky.
Who he's already? Yeah. Who's already said he's disappointed with?
Yeah. So it might be I'm giving him one last chance. Once I find out that he's already got Ike the Spike, this is my contingency plan. You guys go to Vegas, take that guy out, and finally kill this fucker and get this over with.
Right. We also had the interesting question in this episode that we've gotten more details on since, with Mr. C sending Diane, and maybe not just Diane, but Diane got it, a text saying, around the dinner table, the conversation is lively. Obviously, we saw more that was not just a, like, it wasn't, she was baffled by it because we couldn't tell from the reaction here.
Yeah.
But there's definitely some sort of thing between the two of them, which is odd. Considering her reaction to seeing him in the jail cell seemed so shocked.
And you find out in 10, she replied to him because he intercepted that text and she gave him coordinates and all kinds of stuff. So she's
blackmailed her.
But how would she even have had that information?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think it's like, at least I hope that it's not a case of like Dan being evil or being some sort of double agent. But I think it might be something where maybe Mr. C has something on her. He's blackmailing her somehow, you know, and she's sort of being forced into that position of having to give up these coordinates
or
and all that.
I stand by my long theory that Mr. C at this point is actually becoming Cooper again. That's kind of the signal that he's like, he's coming back and he's not evil anymore. Completely outlandish and more than likely bullshit, but I still stand by it.
I heard some people theorizing that Mr. C is becoming more that way and Dougie is becoming more a certain way and they're being pulled towards each other
and
because it's not that one's going to go away. They're not complete without the other. Each one is half of Cooper.
Yeah.
And they need to be merged, which seems like the most convincing theory I've heard so far. But
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, and there's so many things about twins and duplicates here in this show.
Yeah.
Diane is a double agent. She's making it seem like, Mr. C, I'm on your side, getting the information so she can somehow help the Cooper that she...
Yeah, maybe Cole has something going on with her there, you know, like that just Tammy and Albert don't even know about.
It's
it
possible.
Would be like Cole to keep things from them.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And, or the one thing I also heard someone suggest is that what if when she was visited by Evil Cooper way back in the day, she was replaced... And she's a doppelganger.
Yeah.
Because she definitely doesn't seem like the same sort of person that you would assume she was back when.
Yeah.
She's dark.
She's definitely bitter, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I know that's a stretch, but still, maybe she was affected. I don't know. Also, with the Dougie's prints on the coffee cup about being run, how long does it take to run a set of fucking fingerprints?
To be fair, it is South Dakota.
Yeah. But, you know, you think you'd send them to the FBI, it's like, done. Okay.
Well, and I think that's what's going to happen is they do that, and then that's going to cause, you know, Cooper's fingerprints to show up on... You know, Gordon Cole's radar.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It kind of seems like at this point that we've got a lot of our characters converging in South Dakota right now, and they're kind of wrapping up all the South Dakota stuff after this episode.
They're heading towards the same place.
And there might be like a quick stop in Las Vegas before everybody all heads towards Twin Peaks for the end of all this.
There is kind of like a weird thing about time, though, because with the cylinder that they get, it's like, you know, oh, this certain date that's in a couple of days.
Yeah.
But that's clearly like a week or so earlier. So
yeah.
Like, do they just tell time? I don't think everything's happening at the same time.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk. There's a 9-day difference between South Dakota and everything else that we're saying. But it's still unclear for sure. There was something about like a weather report, I think, in episode 10 on the TV where people were like, oh, there was some information in there that seems to lead that there's 9 days. And I was like, really? Because I don't understand your math, but that's me. Everyone's great at the maths. As the British would say. Also, Dougie sitting there staring at the flag with the song, with playing the patriotic song, which is clearly, you know, a little bit of Cooper going through, like, you used to work for the government. You know, I don't know if he'd be as much a patriot these days. and then, of course, once again, the red shoes, as they, like, you know, there's a big color red and red shoes specifically, which is, you know, a Lynch thing, period.
Well, after that, also, they're the same shoes that Audrey wore in the first episode of the first season, so...
And then him switching his view to the wall socket makes more sense, because that's where he came out. That's a, you know...
And part of me still holding out that, like, you know, Cooper getting back to normal, this is all part of some weird Wizard of Oz thing, where... Because when he went through the wall socket the first time, he left his shoes behind.
Yeah.
And then maybe, like, somehow him getting his shoes back is what's gonna, you know... snap him out of it, you know, so him looking at the shoes and then looking at the wall socket. There's something going on there, maybe,
and
other than it being Audrey.
And you go back to the original series with Leo, new shoes over and over again. What the hell's that about?
Hilarious.
Maybe it's these new shoes.
Didn't he hide something in his old work boots or his new? No, he bought new work boots and cut something and hid something in it.
think it was like codes or something like that.
Yeah, so shoes were really important for Leo. That's cracking me up.
And Dougie's kind of the same, kind of like spaced out, like, I'm Dougie. Or kind of like Leo's kind of spaced out.
Yeah, there's a lot of
Leo was shot, and, you know.
And now we have Candy acting all spaced out as well, which is like, I wonder if there's any connection to her, like if she was at one point in the Black Lodge. Someone suggested that what if she is, like, what if she is, what's her name, Annie.
Oh, that would be something,
One, I think for my count for the funniest moment of this episode is Detective Mackley talking to Cole and Albert and everybody. It says the principal's having an affair with a librarian, the librarian showing up dead with Major Briggs's headless body, the principal's wife turning up dead and killed by her lawyer, the principal's secretary also dead, a car explosion, and Albert saying, what happens in season two? Just classic Albert.
I apologize for Albert in advance. He's one of those friends you can't take anywhere. Snarky,
I am so, like, really struck right now with seeing Albert being such a great character in this season.
Yeah.
And I actually just watched the movie The Night Flyer a couple days ago, the old Stephen King movie from the 90s, which is campy but fun, but he plays the main character, who's this total, like, hard-boiled journalist for, like, a Weekly World News type rag, but in a world where that shit really does happen.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, Miguel Ferrer, he was great.
Yeah.
He was a great one.
Also, Albert and Constance flirting.
You have to admit, the people online, they go, oh, they're going to hit it off. And I'm like, oh, it's reaching. And they, I said, oh, yeah, you guys are good at this. I
actually went out on a date. Cole and Tammy are all like, oh, squee.
Yeah.
I love how excited Albert looks, like in that shot where he's talking to Constance. He looks so happy, you know, and that's so unlike Albert.
He found it.
So there was an interesting moment between Diane and Cole when they were sharing a cigarette on the steps outside the police station. He says, we used to smoke together way back when, remember? And she says, yeah, we sure did, Gordon. And that's not what's interesting. What's interesting is this whole scene, Tammy looked so uncomfortable. She's like really awkward and fidgety. And then a little later, we start to see why, where she's the one who's like, something's wrong with Diane.
Yeah.
Like, I don't trust her. And she's the one who's like, something's up here. So that made more sense after the fact.
She's also not a great actress. Let's be fair about that, too.
Yeah, so far, I haven't seen her do anything that really smacked me. But, you know, like I said, Lynch is so exacting with what he wants people to do on screen. I can't imagine that, you know, she's so drastically fidgety and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It looked very intentional. Matthew Lillard, we got our last three episodes, presumably, unless we get some Black Lodge Lillard in there somewhere. Acting his ass off here in this episode here that and in episode 11. These others came in, he said, and they grabbed me by the neck and they pushed me down and said, what's your wife's name? What's your wife's name? Briggs doing the Cooper, you know, once again, the two saying Cooper twice, just like in the message that we see a little bit later in this episode. You know, he says, Tammy asking, did the major kill Ruth? And Bill saying, there were so many people there. I loved her. We were going to go to the Bahamas. We were going to scuba dive and drink mixed drinks on the beach. And we were going to soak up the sun and look at beautiful sunsets. R.I.P. Bill.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, that whole scene is like such a interesting kind of data dump of like all of this crazy stuff about, you know, what I'm assuming, where Major Briggs has been, that, you know, basically confirmed that, the Black Lodge inhabitants, probably the woodsmen, were the ones responsible for the death of Ruth Davenport. And maybe, you know, by the simple act of, like, Hastings, you know, finding Major Briggs, you know, in hibernation, that alerted the woodsmen to find Major Briggs, and that's how they killed him, and that's maybe what kind of set all this off, like with the...
There seems to be some sort of talk, a lot of talk I've seen in a lot of different places suggesting the woodsmen aren't evil. Mm-hmm. They're just barrier guardians.
Mm.
They're just kind of like, no, this is not supposed to... never the twain shall meet people.
Yeah.
You know, like these things, you're getting in too close.
That would make sense considering where they popped up thus far. It's like any time, at least present day, not counting the stuff in the 50s, present day, whenever they show up,
they were young and crazy then.
Yeah. It is whenever people are kind of starting to kind of sniff around their neck of the woods, as it were. You know, that's when one of them will show up to kind of try and ward somebody
but
away.
But if that was true, and this is jumping to episode 11, mm-hmm. I would have think they would have ripped Cole's head off and not poor Bill Hastings.
That's true. That's so. True. Although Hastings was the one who was spilling the beans, so maybe they were thinking, you know.
It's true.
Yeah, they definitely.
You know, kill him before he tells them anything else, or I don't know.
By the way, just on that point, which is skipping ahead, and I have no idea if this is intentional or not, but when it was pointed out to me, I laughed out loud. Because Hastings dies, top of his head blown yeah. off. David Lynch looks down at him and says, in the so most crazy. Deadpan voice imaginable, he's dead. And someone pointed out dead plus brain pan equals deadpan. And yeah. Like, isn't yeah. that fun? I'm like, I doubt it, but that's funny to think
about. He talks like an almost in a parrot type of voice. Looks like he's dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so... and
jumping to 11 again, because we're talking about this now. Mackley's response to that was still, I laughed out loud. Yeah. Oh my God! Oh my God! It's the most realistic reaction I've ever seen in anything ever. I
thought it was pretty amazing,
I
too.
Love that.
Well, and also the wound on his head looks mm-hmm. a lot like the autopsy photos of the people in New York from all the way back in episode 3, like the same way their heads kind of caved in.
Yeah.
So this energy gets too close.
Yeah.
And you're not sure if it's how it's happening, but the electrical energy or the surge or the black smoke or the black fire or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something going on.
Maybe the zombie's coming. I don't know. at this point, I'm like, oh no, don't go there.
Going back to episode 9, we get to see Bobby having a rare moment of insight that nobody else has.
Yeah.
You know, the Major Briggs, oh yeah, he taught me how to open these things. And I'm like, wait, what? As they get the metal cylinder we discussed about in the synopsis here, where like his mother's like, yes, I was given this, and wait till the day you show up. And he's got to like throw it on the ground twice and get the resonant sound to open it.
I'm
so, wow. I was like, okay. But, you know, I mean, obviously we all but forgot about it once they actually open it. We're like, oh, new pertinent information.
Yeah.
It is really weird if you look at Bobby Briggs' life. Before it was just, oh, he's a malcontent, wayward, coke dealing, you know, shoots a cop by accident, Woods kind of football player kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then his dad is...
Typical.
Yeah, typical in some American way. But his dad is, like, time traveling and shows him how to open these silver discs. And it's like, whoa, he's become far more intriguing. And yet he didn't really talk about it with any of his classmates, by the way.
Well, he's like, and now he's like, you know, as they pointed out, he's becoming what his dad wanted him to be, you know. Yeah. Not only has he become an officer of the law, but, you know, like working with the authorities, but he is involved as part of the Bookhouse Boys, clearly, and being, you know, I look forward to seeing if we gather more Bookhouse Boys.
Yeah.
And make some old appearances or whatever.
Yeah, and he definitely just seems like more of a stand-up guy now than he was.
He's actually kind of, in a way, I think he's become like the hero of the show because he's like a good guy. And again, not jumping to episode 11,
but
he's become like this. He's become something really good. Like with talking about his father, the look in his eye. He acted his ass off. Here's a guy who was, you know, chastised for being such a ham bone in the original series. Like, oh my God. Now he's like really just taking it very seriously. And it's really, I thought it was quite moving.
And then, you know, he awkwardly has to watch Shelley doing exactly the wrong thing
again.
All over again later.
With someone who's basically him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the note that was inside said cylinder, of course, had the two Twin Peaks symbols that we also saw in the owl cave, and then the green ring, or maybe it is, in fact, just a pair of Twin Peaks. It has the crescent moon upended over that symbol that we saw on the playing card that Evil Coop had, mm-hmm. which comes up again in episode 11 when we see Hawk's map, when Hawk cryptically says, oh, you don't want to know about that.
Maybe the experiment, but maybe not.
Yeah, so you definitely don't want to know anything about that. Like, great, okay. But, you know, we get the story of Jack Rabbit's house, which wasn't that Jack Rabbit Slim's the name of the
bar? In Pulp Fiction,
I kept thinking of that. I was like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
But, Jack Rabbit's house, the imaginary world that Major Briggs would, like he and my Bobby, would, when Bobby was a kid, would go to tell stories, what have you. And once again, like I said, the Cooper in between a bunch of numbers that no one seems to be putting together with anything else that I've seen.
And then the 253.
Yes, you know, which is the time they're supposed to be there exactly.
Wow. And that was also the time that way back in episode three when Dougie went in the lodge and Evil Cooper started vomiting up all the cream corn. It was at 2:53.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, that was the clock on the dashboard on his car.
Catch.
Was at 2:53, and that was the time that he was telling them in the episode before. That's when I have to be alone because that's when I'm supposed to go back in. So. Nice.
So obviously all this information is quickly coming to a head, maybe even in the next episode. You know, it's hard to say at this point. Yeah. One or two episodes, I suspect they're going to be at the place at the time.
Yeah. Or will they?
Or will they? Going to poor Jerry Horn, who's still just lost in the woods tripping balls. not really. Is he on Sparkle? They've recently said the drug of choice in Twin Peaks is called Sparkle.
I wonder if he's the one that's manufacturing it.
I think he might be
distributing it.
Well, I don't know if he's distributing it.
He's selling weed.
Yeah, expensive. Yeah.
But I think
maybe
he might have
sprinkling Sparkle on the weed.
Yeah, I think he might have taken.
It's like Thai stick, like chocolate Thai stick. You just put Sprinkle on instead. Little Pony Thai stick.
Yeah, I think he might have taken it because we're kind of seeing, you know, like we saw Richard Horn take it earlier, and he kind of was acting sort of the same way, and I suspect. Later in this episode and the next couple of episodes, we see some people around the town acting like really weird and kind of like just out of their mind. And I'm suspecting it has something to do with that drug. You're kind of getting the sense that this is going throughout the town.
This drug is pretty big and pretty nasty.
Yeah. And they mentioned earlier in the season, like they had a kid at the high school OD'd on it. So it's clearly it's starting to get around. And that was the thing that when we were first introduced to Bobby that Truman was asking him about. He didn't know what it was or where it was coming from. So I'm thinking it's all this same drug and it's just... slowly inhabiting everybody in the town.
Now, do you think the whole
small,
the whole "I am not your foot" is just him tripping and it's just being weird?
Probably, yeah.
Felt like to me. Drug, whether if it's the legal pot or the sparkle motion, it's ripping a hole into the dimensions where he's seen the portal because it seems like he's wandering dangerously close to that grove.
Mm-hmm.
And so, didn't he say to the foot, "I've been here before"?
Yeah.
Is he in another episode?
Like, you're saying the same thing. Yeah. He's in the same team last time, which means he's kind of in a loop or something.
Yeah, he's getting really close to that.
Also, Jack Rabbit,
energy.
Rabbit Foot.
I don't know. You know, the jokes that are hokey, though, it's not beyond David Lynch. It's like a 50s old dad joke.
Also,
that's really into this.
Because
so
where is
it's
he?
Possible.
Yeah, he could very well be where that is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He might be.
I'd love that. If that's the big reveal, is they find the place as Jerry Horn out in the woods for 4 days. Like, thank God you found me.
Is this my foot?
Roll credits.
We have an argument. meanwhile, we see Benjamin Horn and Beverly, Ashley Judd's character, still almost getting it on.
Yeah.
You know, they're continuing this weird flirtation where he's like, no. At first, I was like, because before we were like, oh, well, he's married and she's married, so he's being a good guy. But since we've seen, he's definitely not married anymore.
Yeah.
At least not to his wife from before.
Yeah.
But she is. So he's like, oh, I'm just not doing it because you're your husband. And I'm like, all right. And the whole thing with the husband being that. In that bad shape. I mean, I feel like something's going to happen to that guy before long. Because otherwise, why even bother with this whole flirtation unless it's going to go somewhere?
Yeah.
You know? Which, you know, speaking of that, Johnny Horn running through the house. Just that single thing where I was like, I had to look it up. I was like, who the fuck was that? Because you see a guy run at the wall and knock himself out. And you're like, okay, Twin Peaks.
It was such a weird showing the house. It was almost like when they show the fan at Laura's house. Mm-hmm. It was just this weird, ominous... kind of Kubrick type of shot, and then dun 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 Johnny, and the mom just sounded crazy drunk. I mean, I don't think she was, but she sounded like whatever in the Baby Jane kind of voice.
Yeah.
Like, oh man. So
well, and also it kind of struck me. I don't know if this is supposed to be anything intentional, but it, in a weird way, like it kind of reminded me of the end of season two because Johnny's wearing like very Cooper-esque blue pajamas. And is running headfirst into a wall,
true.
You know.
I didn't think about that.
And that was something the first time I saw it that kind of stuck out to me because I think he had the same color of blue that he was wearing. And so again, I don't know if that's supposed to mean anything or if it's just a fun little callback.
Somebody needs to make a craft brewer needs to make a beer called Annie's Beer. Crazy Dale Cooper.
Maybe Johnny is like they said that he got pushed down the stairs by Audrey, and when he had that brain injury. Maybe he, you know how you're right on the kind of a cusp of a coma. Mm-hmm. He's got one foot in Earth and the other in the afterworld. Maybe he can see and pick up the events that are occurring. That's why he's getting kind of agitated and starting to, like, move around and bump his head. Like, when he hit the wall, the waterfall fell.
Yeah.
It felt like it was. It really focused on that picture.
It just wasn't a random picture.
And so this is the first thing, episode in this, that had outside media tie into it, which was brilliant. William Hastings having had a long time running since 1997, quantum physics conspiracy website called The Search for the Zone. You can look it up at thesearchforthezone.com.
It's like a flashback.
And there's, this is like a GeoCities site. It's like old school, and like lots of flashy like stuff, it says last updated November 2015. And there's notes there about, like, you know, multiple universes and about stuff from Robert Heinlein for some reason. A lot of the links here just take you to official Twin Peaksy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, oh, here's a weird video that you have no idea what you can't even tell what's happening
in. But in a weird way, this does kind of go back to a lot of the government conspiracy stuff that's in the secret history of Twin Peaks. Granted, a lot more of that has to do with UFOs, but there's a little bit of it in that book that kind of touches on, like, you know, time travel and alternate dimensions and all that.
Well, I mean, stuff that has been discussed a lot recently is, like, there's stuff about electricity from Nikola Tesla here.
Yeah.
You know, there's still a lot of stuff about parallel universes. Obviously, we're dealing with a lot of dualities on the show. It's interesting to read through, but there's nothing I thought was terribly essential. You know, and there's a link at the very bottom. If you click on one of the trees, it'll take you to a place you can pre-order the soundtrack.
I'm not saying I did.
I'm not saying you didn't either. We also got given in this episode the coordinates, which people were like, wait, where are the coordinates?
Yeah.
They are actually in South Dakota, in what they call the Black Hills of South Dakota.
I'm actually going on a road trip in 2 weeks, part of my path is going through South Dakota, through the Black Hills.
Sweet. Well, there was actually a whole photo essay someone put up where they found the exact spot, and there was nothing there. It was just
he said something about a can.
Yeah, he found a buried can.
With cement and a bullet hole, like a bullet hole.
Yeah, but they were still like, okay, but that could be nothing. That could just be garbage that's out there. You know,
Black Hills, South Dakota has really interesting energy.
Somebody on Twitter asked Mark Frost if it would be safe to visit it, and he said, you tell me.
I'll go there. Good shot.
Yeah, that's
I'll
crazy.
Let you know, and I'll be right back.
The question being, did someone go there before this guy and grab whatever was there and just hasn't said anything? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's possible. I think back to in the, not Cloverfield, in the 10 Cloverfield Lane trailer, deeply hidden inside that thing. Like, I watch it and I can't even find it, were coordinates.
What?
Somebody found that, went to the coordinates, and buried in the ground was a whole, like, Cloverfield fan gift set with a bunch of, like, gimme stuff in it.
That's very cool. That's cool marketing.
But I don't know if that's what the deal was here. Hmm. So, like, you know, time will tell.
You could bury some treat there for the next Twin Peaks fan to find. Like a letter in a bottle. Pass it on.
And then we saw another musician here at the end at the Roadhouse, but who wasn't playing. She was just a well-known musician playing the character of Ella, a junkie with a very bad armpit rash.
Oh,
apparently.
Probably Sparkle.
That's Sky Ferreira. Another famous musician who I've never heard of.
She definitely does not look like in this show. She just looks horrible. I didn't recognize her. I was like, that's her?
And she and her friend having that weird code, that zebra's out again, and the penguin. It's like, what the fuck did that mean? Characters we've never seen.
I think this is, again, like, you know, like we've seen a couple times in this season, some sort of like low-key drug deal going on in the middle of the Roadhouse.
Yeah. So the Roadhouse has got some sleazy...
That's how they pay for Nine Inch Nails. They gotta, you know.
They need to put
all those drugs
in that thing, and he'd clean that shit up.
That's how this whole show's gonna end: is Good Cooper ripping the throat out of Evil Cooper, and then karate kicking him into a lake.
Yeah, but then Ghost Patrick Swayze shows up and fixes everything.
It's gonna be the best season of TV ever.
You know, and then at the very end, everyone jumps and goes. Freeze frame.
Yeah, exactly. No, Bobby's walking across the football field and puts his fist up in the air and freeze frames.
It's the sunset in the background.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be beautiful.
All right, so we go to episode 10, the Wikipedia synopsis, as thus. Carl Rod, by the way, love Carl so much. Yeah, he's the superhero of Twin Peaks, I think. Carl Rod listens to Stephen, Caleb Landry Jones, berate and beat his wife, Becky, Amanda Seyfried, and says, "It's a fucking nightmare." Richard Horn confronts Miriam, who tells him she has written to Sheriff Truman about the hit and run. He attacks her, turns on the gas, and lights a candle in her trailer, then has Deputy Chad, Deputy Chad, intercept the letter. Chad is such an asshole. Not only is he doing that, but he's fucking with, Lucy, just to fuck with her. Yeah. Like, you're like, man, you're such a prick.
Yeah.
The Mitchums, the gangsters, see a news story about Ike's arrest and recognize Cooper as Mr. Jackpots. After noticing Cooper's physique, Janie E. has crazy sex. Nadine Hurley watches Dr. Jacoby's latest broadcast from her drapery store. I love she finally gets the drapery store.
Run Silent, Run Drapes. Run That's the best store name ever. Like,
that was amazing.
He's a true artist.
Richard attacks his grandmother Sylvia in her home and robs her. She calls Ben and demands money from him, Sylvia being Ben's ex-wife. Duncan Todd orders Anthony Sinclair to frame Dougie for the denial of an arson insurance claim that lost the Mitchums $30 million. Gordon has a vision of Laura, and it turns out to be Albert. Albert informs him that the FBI has intercepted a text message from Diane informing someone of Hastings' arrest. Tammy then shows them a photo that places Cooper's doppelganger at the location of the New York murders, which was, whoa.
Yeah.
Hawk receives another call from the log lady who tells him Laura is the one. And then, and probably the most, wow, what does this really mean, sequence of musical sequence we've seen so far ending an episode, Rebecca Del Rio, who fans of Mulholland Drive will remember is the Silencio sequence singer, sings of No Stars at the end. Song written by David Lynch. Also interesting because she's singing in front of red curtains and her dress is the pattern of the floor and the colors of the floor of the Black Lodge. It was like, this has got to mean something, right?
And I feel, maybe I'm making this up, but like I feel like there was some sort of reference or something a couple episodes ago to like there not being any stars or anything like that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm making that
darkness
up, but
The glow is, Log Lady said something, the glow is dying. Electricity's fading.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think that Twin Peaks, as the Black Lodge is ready to reopen up, that whatever light is there, was there, it's dimming. And the darkness, as you can see, the town's getting really crazy. Now,
this episode had an awful lot of violence against women.
Yes,
so
it did.
We're very clear. You know, we're like, okay, I mean, it was disturbing to watch. And I felt that way as well. In some ways, this was my least favorite episode to watch because it was so grim, unrelentingly. I did read an interesting viewpoint that was saying Laura's role in this might be that she will sort of be the light that possesses all these ladies in the town to be like, take no shit.
Nice. Guns.
And that maybe there'll be like something happened to Amanda Seyfried to Becky where she's already starting to get a taste of like Laura in her life where she's like...
Well, and we find that Miriam is not dead because Richard's apparently the worst killer ever.
Yeah, he's not great at killing. Except That's little kids with his truck. He's great at that.
He's really good at that one.
And then of course, you know, with the ghost to Laura Palmer appearing, they're really sort of wanting you to reminding you Laura is going to be very pertinent.
Yeah.
Don't forget that, like, Laura's, it's not just something that happened in the first season. She is somehow the key to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very confusing because we've gotten very little data on what exactly, how exactly that would work. All we can do is wild theories. Albert being told about Mr. C texting Diane and Mr. Cole telling him, you know, keep her close. Like, you know, keep an eye on her, which is exactly what we see Albert doing. Much to Diane's chagrin. And then, of course, Gordon Cole making that doodle, which I was like, did you not pause it and go like, oh, what is it? And turn your head upside down? Which people have described as a reindeer creature with huge antlers and a hand attached to an elongated arm reaching into the picture from outside the border. Someone also pointed out that I didn't notice is next to his pad was a small red box that looked very similar to the one Mr. C called from prison. Don't know if that's pertinent. Or other people pointed out the reindeer looked like the world's angriest dog from the comic strip that David Lynch used to draw.
Yeah.
Which seems more likely.
Yeah, probably more
likely. Isn't there a Mr. Reindeer in Wild at Heart.
And Wild at Heart. And
as well, he was a hitman.
In this same episode, we see reindeers on the Christmas decorations inside of Miriam's trailer.
Yeah.
Reindeers seeming to be pertinent. That broken teddy bear with a light bulb head for Johnny Horn's house saying repeatedly, "Hello, Johnny, how are you today?" That was almost as annoying as the horn honking in episode 11.
It builds more intensity because you're like, this horrific violence is happening to Grandma Horn. And you can't get this teddy bear won't stop talking. You're like, stop, make it stop. And just this intensity of feeling helpless. You can't help her. You can't help Johnny. You can't help anything. It's just being forced to watch this horrible violence.
It was just almost absurd. This is going on while this teddy bear with that...
No head
and a light bulb that is apparently its voice track is broken.
It just sounds like torture.
Yeah, it sounds like she's torturing Johnny almost.
And then you wonder, what kind of woman is Sylvia? Because in pilot, she was saying to Audrey, just tell him that Laura's not coming. He's never coming again. How hard is that? And it's like, that seems really kind of cruel. Like someone died.
Yeah.
Like... You know, how is he going to understand if he's got, like, you know, a head wound or a mental issue or... I don't know Johnny's real problem.
Yeah, I remember
it's hard enough to understand if you just...
All I remember is Audrey felt responsible for him back in the day, back in the original show. Like, I don't know. I always felt the whole Johnny Horn story was very, like, not terribly well explored.
Yeah,
it's just by the way, and you're kind of like, wow, that's interesting.
The weird relationship that the Mitchum brothers have with their pink girls, Candy, Mandy, and Sandy, especially Candy, who in this episode we see her more animated than she's ever been, trying to kill a fly with a remote control, unfortunately bashing the shit out of one of the brothers' heads by doing it. Very funny scene, but someone pointed out it was reminds of The Fly in season 2 with Lucy when she's obsessed with a fly and Andy is telling her that he's sterile. The doctor says he's sterile and she's just kind of like oblivious trying to kill a fly in the office.
Right.
I had totally forgotten about that. And why are Sandy, Candy, and Mandy so completely oblivious? Like, I mean, to the point where they're like, they're either out of the Black Lodge, like we said earlier, or they're just on heavy doses of drugs.
They're on heavy doses of drugs.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of weird, and it's bizarre, and it's very strange, but I think they're his girls. They're mobsters. They're like
used
little,
to
the
this.
Malls.
Yeah. They're malls. There is.
But she's out of it to a point where you're like,
I know some
get her
people,
some help.
I know some people like this, and they're not on drugs. I do think it is... dissociative.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to go into the real psychology, if Candy was this... Her backstory, the actress said that she was human trafficked and the brothers saved her. If that's true, and let's say she's not on drugs, she's dissociative, and living this lifestyle with the Mitchum brothers is a godsend. It's like heavenly, where she's being treated much better.
Yeah.
Because when she smacks him with that remote, I was like, that guy is going to go Frank...
But
I was scared.
But the brothers have a weird paternal thing with the girls,
just
where they're as much as they get frustrated by them, they're kind of like, oh, you.
Well, there's that whole line that Jim Belushi has where he's like, well, if we fire her, she has nowhere else to go. You know, we can't get rid of her.
Like, maybe playing on that weird stereotype that was put out in movies at one time, that Italian mobsters, they'll put out a hit, they'll kill you if you do them wrong, but they won't touch the women. They put them on pedestals. So maybe he's making a reference to...
Well, they will in The Sopranos.
Making a reference to however, like, this 50s dreamy concept of gangsters have their morals, too. Like,
yeah, I mean, it is odd how the Mitchum brothers, who initially we looked at as, like, Class C villains, they actually made you kind of really like them over the space of these last couple of episodes. Oh, you're like, oh, they're kind of sweet in their way. Yeah.
Jim Belushi especially, like the moment he first showed up, I was like, all right, here we go.
Yeah.
And then since then, he's become like one of my favorite new characters.
Oh, yeah, me too.
We met this season.
They've given him so many great moments, especially in episode 11, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
And I love the Mitchum brothers going, wow, so it turns out Mr. Jones is actually called Mr. Jones. Talking about Dougie, which is very funny. And watching that whole thing, we're kind of like, I felt very nervous because I'm like, great, this is just what he needs, more shit in his life. But of course, we had nothing to worry about as it turned out. Jerry Horn still running around Ghostwood Forest on drugs. Oh, yeah, and also, if Benjamin Horne is married to Sylvia still, or is not married to her still, why does he still have his wedding ring?
Maybe they're just separated, they're not actually, like, divorced.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the process of being divorced.
It's possible that, yeah, they're just a very...
And he also seems to indicate, he doesn't, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I apologize.
Oh, no.
He also seems to not like the fact that she's, you know, considerably younger, and that seems to give him pause. Mm-hmm. And I think he regrets maybe how he was years earlier, where he was with all the people that, he's like, maybe I was a horrible person. Maybe I shouldn't do that anymore.
Well, yeah. not
that
too much.
Down in season two.
Yeah.
And that weird breakdown. So maybe.
And he tried to kind of redeem himself after that. I love that at the moment he gets off the phone with Sylvia, he's just like, "Hey Beverly, you want to go to dinner?"
Yeah,
true.
This is too much now. Yeah.
Okay, so this next thing I'm going to read out, this came from one of the analysis sites, and I can't remember, I forgot to write it down if it was Entertainment Weekly, which does a great job breaking down the synopsises, the New York Times, or Vox, or AV Club, I'm not really sure. Actually, I found Entertainment Weekly, if you're looking for a metaphorical interpretation, does, believe it or not, the best job of any of these sites. But they, so that's why I'm thinking this is from that, but talking about Johnny while Sylvia is being attacked, says, as this scene played out, Johnny wanted so badly to help his mom. He was bound in a straitjacket and tethered to a chair. He toppled over and tried to break free, but he couldn't. A portrait of impotence. Combined with a decapitated teddy bear with the plastic cartoon-eyed replacement head, a debasement of a symbol for innocence transmogrified into some postmodern monster toy, the whole thing struck me as a metaphor for pop culture's deconstruction and distrust of classical heroism. The music played to these meanings. It was an orchestral rendition of a 1926 pop song, Charmaine, composed for the film What Price Glory. Yet the most famous use of an orchestral version was in Milos Forman's Oscar-winning adaptation of Ken Kesey's novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. In that movie, a mental institution is used as a metaphor for degrading conformist society, and the main character, an outlaw, feigning mental illness and to escape a prison sentence becomes a metaphor for corrective counterculture rebellion. So some interesting, like, deep cut stuff to possibly throw into the mix of the scene that definitely felt like there was a lot more going on than we were aware of on the
surface.
Or,
this is a recurring nightmare that David Lynch has had. He's like, I'm going to put the show on screen. This is fucking terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible.
Well, and I think this scene pretty much confirms that Audrey Horne is Richard Horne's mom.
Seems to be because
no one mentioned. There's no one else.
Yeah,
there's Donna because
that's true. Yeah. But I feel like
it does seem odd, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that would be weird. And I feel like it kind of goes back to that whole conversation with Doc Hayward a couple episodes back, where maybe Evil Cooper is actually the father of Richard Horne. That.
Yeah.
Seems like this episode might be confirming that, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the very least, she's the mother.
She's the mother, definitely.
Yeah. There's no... Yeah. She's the father and the mother. Yeah.
And still raises the question, 11 episodes in, and still no Audrey Horne, who we know very well was cast in this and will appear in it.
Well,
like, what is he waiting for?
I think she's definitely... I don't think she's living in Twin Peaks. I think she... Yeah. I mean, she might be in Vegas, but I don't know. She's definitely... It seems like from this episode... The fact that all this goes down the Horne family and no one thinks to call Audrey.
Maybe she's still in the hospital.
That's what I'm
saying. True.
Maybe she never came out of the coma.
Because it seems like she's a strong enough person, she would have something to say to him about this.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking she never fully recovered. She might be a lot like Johnny.
Mm.
But why isn't she sitting next to Johnny? So it must, maybe she's still in the coma.
Yeah.
Or in an institution of some sort.
Yeah, I kept thinking she's either still, she's damaged in that way, either in a coma or mentally damaged in, like, you know, like an institution or something. Or you're right, she moved out of Twin Peaks. She's like, fuck this place. Which who could blame anyone? I mean, I left my hometown because it was fucked up, but it was nothing fucked up like that.
Your bank didn't explode.
Nobody was wrapped in plastic down by the lake, you know? one connection I saw people was making Rodney and Bradley Mitchum's relationship, Ben and Jerry Horne's relationship, the two, like, you know, corporate brothers, if you will, and then Candy, Mandy, and Sandy being the way they're kind of being used by them, the way they're woman in a box to the trapped woman of One-Eyed Jacks. You know, maybe we'll get some pretty dark stuff on the Mitchum brothers in the future to take away our feelings of somewhat warmth towards them lately. Maybe not. And then, of course, we mentioned earlier Mr. C appearing in the photo from the glass box in New York City. He appears to be the mysterious billionaire who was funding the operation.
And maybe this is part of, you know, one of his many contingency plans for if Cooper got out of the Black Lodge. You know, this is one of five or six different backup plans he had set up to make sure.
Was it a trap to capture him or to capture something else?
I would think probably him, since he was the first thing that came out. And then mother, whatever came after, you know, essentially chasing him. So I think this is all part of a way to you know, that, like he had the camera set up. So maybe, you know, okay, I see, you know, we see on the camera feed, Cooper shows up. Okay, I know that he's going to pop out in Las Vegas, so I'll have my guys ready in Las Vegas, you know, on standby, basically. So if I hear from my people in New York that he showed up, then the people in New York can take him out. And this is all part of a very complex, complicated plan to make sure that he gets... killed.
If the mother slash experiment made it through that glass box, where the hell is she right now?
Good, very good question.
And who's she touching? You know, because it's getting too close, obviously, makes your head implode or
explode. I mean, did she manifest in the woodsman that we see in episode 11?
Yeah.
I don't know. Speaking of episode 11, here's the Wikipedia synopsis. A group of children discover Miriam crawling from the underbrush. Becky learns her husband, Stephen, has been cheating on her with Gersten Hayward, who played this role as a small girl in the original show, who actually they got her to come back. I was like, damn, that's authenticity. Although, we get Gersten, but no Donna. That's what we were hoping for, right?
What about the girl who writes poetry? I can't remember her name.
No, that was Gersten.
No. Gersten was the redhead who played the piano.
Played the piano.
Kind of precocious, wearing
come on, everybody, get happy.
For
some reason, I thought she was the niece, because I was like, who is this precocious kid? I thought she was kind of bratty. I don't know where I got that from.
She was also the little girl in Dune.
Yes, she was.
She's very young.
No.
So Becky drives to an apartment and shoots through the door, looking, presumably Gersten's apartment, thinking that Stephen is there with her. But the couple are elsewhere. In fact, they are at the bottom of the stairs looking up going, fuck!
Yeah.
At the diner, Becky's parents, Shelley and Bobby, which is confirmed for us, chastise her over the incident. Red arrives. That's Balthazar Getty's role, who is the guy who can make dimes disappear in the air and is selling sparkle everywhere. And Shelley leaves to kiss him. Shelley, once again, making terrible choices. After a child fires a gun through the diner window, Bobby discovers an anxious woman with a sick girl in her car. That's putting it mildly. I would just say a flat-out zombie. At the location where Hastings met Briggs, the FBI finds Ruth's body with coordinates on one arm. Gordon sees woodsmen in a portal and is drawn back by Albert. A woodsman kills Hastings. While Hawk and Truman study an ancient map, Hawk receives a phone call from the log lady who tells him, there's fire where you're going. Dougie's boss gives Cooper a check for $30 million to give to the Mitchums. The Mitchums plan to kill Cooper, but after Bradley has a prophetic dream, they realize he is an ally and take him for drinks and cherry pie.
Yes.
All right, so first off, Miriam's alive! Awesome. So relieved to see
that. A woman didn't die. That's awesome. Yeah.
Miriam's alive. Kids are traumatized for the rest of their lives.
Yes, they are.
Also, those kids, that is like the worst game of catch I've seen in quite some time.
Yeah, they're not great. But, you know, it's so, like, whenever, it's a very Lynchian move. Where the way he's moving the camera real fast has this
really bad.
You know, when he does something like that, you're like, something is about to happen. Yeah. Fucked up. Yeah. You know,
I'm like, one of those kids gonna get hit by a car. Holy shit!
That's what we were waiting for.
Yeah, when he ran out in the street, I was like, nope, don't do this again. Nope.
It's Richard again. Oh my god!
That's keys away.
I gotta admit, I really laughed at the sheer melodrama of like. Shelly jumping on the car, holding onto it, and then flying off of it. You see her shoe fly in the air.
It was insane. I'm thinking, Shelly's addicted to drama. She loves this.
Yeah. Well, and that felt like very much a classic Twin Peaks move of like the most over the top sitcom thing that somebody could do, of like jump on the hood of the car and just veer out in oncoming traffic.
Oh my god!
Yeah, I was like, and then of course Shelley's just like, well, whatever.
I have a feeling this happens all the time. Like this is just not because Norma's like. Had this look of not this again.
Yeah.
Like she knows.
Norma's just ready to sell that diner and get the fuck out of town.
She should.
I didn't bring it up during the last episode, but apparently you can't really see it in the way that it's edited in the show. But apparently where the Drape Runner store is right across the street from the Double R.
Oh, okay.
So adding a little bit more salt in that wound, especially if maybe her and Big Ed aren't together anymore.
Right, which we still don't know.
But he has a gas farm.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
We also did see Gersten's apartment was in a building that looks an awful lot like the apartment building where Ruth's was. All those yellow walls.
Yeah.
And which, of course, yellow in Twin Peaks universe is the color of Garmin Bosia, which means pain and suffering.
Yeah.
So we're like, oh, almost certainly has some sort of direct message of like, of that there.
Or another parallel.
Yeah.
So is her husband, Stephen, seeing, is that his mom or is that his lover or is it his sparkle dealer. I can't say sparkle dealer. It's hard to say.
It's implied, like, it's a lover. I mean,
yeah, I assumed it was a lover.
It felt like, but it's like, maybe there's something more.
Maybe there's another level we don't even know about.
Yeah. Maybe he's going there. Because she called him a coward, and I can't believe you did this. And it's like, coward. Did he take all her drugs and, you know, take them all without her? So that's what she's angry about? I didn't hear her say something like cheating.
Yeah, she's also...
It felt like it was a drug thing. Like, how dare you take my drugs and take
some? Yeah. No, I feel like she says it
maybe
later
both.
On. When she's talking to Shelley and Bobby later on, she kind of implies that she's another one. He was cheating on her with
another
one.
Yeah.
It seemed pretty clear to me.
But I love Carl, once again, one of my favorite new characters on the show for sure, Harry Dean Stanton. Shelley's like, help, I need a ride to the double R, and he just calls the Carl-mobile with a whistle. And I love it. It's totally the Carl-mobile. And he gets in there, he's got like a desk and a phone, and he's like, call the police commissioner.
Yeah. Is he a book house member too? If not, he should be.
It feels maybe. Like he is. Carl is the future of Uber.
Yeah.
Like, magic whistle. Okay, Carl is definitely a guardian angel.
Well, it's funny. I thought he was going to call a dog, because when he does it, you hear like the sound of a dog barking in the distance. Oh, we're going to see Carl's dog, and then they cut, and then you just see the van pull up
driving the car.
And then, of course, in that conversation, Becky, who still won't even admit she's being abused, you know, which definitely feels synchronous with Shelley and Leo's relationship. And that whole sequence being so tragic as Bobby is, as we said, watching all this play out and realizing it's just history repeating itself. Which is even more interesting with what happens immediately after that as bullets fly into the double R. Bobby runs out there dealing with this kid who apparently found his dad's gun in the back seat and fired it out the window. Meanwhile, the woman behind them in the car is just incessantly honking on the horn. I actually yelled at the TV screen, shut the fuck up! Yeah. Nothing
so
sets my nerves on
tense.
Edge like somebody just incessantly honking. But that moment that I didn't put together immediately, where Bobby's looking at the kid and then looks over at the dad and sees they're dressed alike, they're even standing alike, and the kid has a sort of like weird, distant look in his eyes, and I was like, I didn't put it together, but he, at that moment, is seeing that, wow, Shelley and Becky, it's just history repeating itself. Yeah. They're the same person.
Well, and it kind of ties back to that whole scene at the end of season two where it's in the double R, and and I just forgot his name. Shelley and Bobby. Thank you. Yeah, it's Shelley and Bobby, and they're both in the diner. It's when he asked her to marry him. But all their dialogue in that scene is the exact same as it was in the pilot. So you're kind of seeing these repetitions in this town happening over and over and over again.
Twin Peaks itself is stuck in a weird loop, loop.
It kind of reminds me of Seattle for me.
Yeah.
Seattle, it seems like a big city, but it's really... It's tiny.
It's very insular.
And it's like the same,
And Austin, for that matter.
Yeah. I just haven't been here long enough for that looping to happen yet. Soon.
But if that's the case, and that is definitely a thing, it makes you wonder if Becky has other lovers as well.
Yeah.
You know, because if she's the new Laura Palmer in some ways, then it makes you think, huh, I wonder if she's got some other action on the side.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, didn't her husband, when he was berating her on the couch, like, ready
to... He said, I know what's going on, or
something. I know what's going on. So I was thinking, does that allude to some kind of weird dealings with... Was it Jacques, or is it his brother at the Roadhouse?
Oh, yeah. Jean-Michel Renault.
Thank you. Because I'm thinking, did she go off and do something to get more drug money, or to score drugs?
It could be. You know, Sparkle apparently is deeply addictive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'd still try it.
Well, and that's, I think... I think
armpit lady, though. Yeah. You don't want to do that.
I'm fine. Scratching my arm.
I think that kid in the car has probably hopped up on Sparkle as well.
Yeah, because we see the kid in the car, like the woman who's driving says, her uncle is joining us. She hasn't seen him in a very long while. We're late. We've got miles to go. We have to go. She's sick. And Bobby's just sitting there like we are watching this. What the fuck? And the kid is just like that. But the kid starts kind of leaning towards her, and she's throwing up green bile, and the woman is like, oh, oh, oh.
And Bobby just has this look like, the fuck.
It's funny and horrifying at the same time.
The mom, I'm assuming, if she's seeing her daughter do this, wouldn't she drive her right to ER? I mean, this is like someone on the brink of death almost. It's like, who's this uncle? I hope he's a doctor at ER.
At some point, people point out the kid looks so creepy. Maybe something's up with that. But yeah, like maybe he was fire. Something made him fire inside the double R.
That's kind of what I wondered. Is the look on his face made me wonder if like the mom is covering and something else is going on.
Yeah, or maybe she just doesn't know.
Yeah.
You know?
And dressed exactly like the father, too.
Yeah.
Now, of course, one of the big telling moments here is Hawk. Well, first off, Sheriff Truman looking at his computer with the coordinates saying, by my reckoning, this is where we're going, but there's no road. The road's gone. And Hawk's like, well, I do have this thing. I have this old tribal map. It's an ancient map he unrolls looking for Jackrabbit's palace. He points out that it's in a mountain peak to the right of the two twin peaks that are drawn very similar to the two triangles that we saw earlier in Major Briggs's note. It says, but that's where Major Briggs's station is, Blue Pine Mountain, which he describes as a revered sacred site. And then when he's going through the symbols, when the Sheriff Truman goes, well, what is that? Is that fire? He goes, well, it's a type of fire. It's like modern day electricity. Truman says, is it good? He says, it depends on the intention behind the fire, which felt like one of those moments that you're like, oh, this is putting other things into a deeper level of perspective.
Yeah.
And obviously that obsession with electricity that's run through Twin Peaks. Yeah. And then saying the whole thing where we get to, corn, which said this is black corn, it represents the opposite of fertility. It represents death. And when that combines with fire, it becomes the black fire, which is fire that causes death. You know, so bad electricity, presumably. Hmm. And then, of course, as we mentioned earlier, when we see the symbol with the crescent half moon turned upside down, and then the black bug looking thing from Mr. C's playing card, is Frank, you don't ever want to know about that. Which I don't know about you, but at that moment, I'd be like, yes, I do.
I want to.
Let's look. Secrets have not served Twin Peaks well.
Yeah.
So, come clean.
He also, Hawk describes the map as very old but very current. It's a living thing, which insinuates it literally changes based on new things that are happening, which is kind of cool. I could use a map. Oh, we do. It's called Google Maps. So. And then, of course, the log lady calling him at that moment when they're looking at it says, my log is afraid of fire. There's fire where you're going, Hawk. There's fire where you're going. Presumably the black fire.
Yeah.
So don't.
Interesting.
He probably should not firewalk with anyone, is the message there.
Yeah.
Oh,
no, go for it.
It's the, you're getting closer to fire, you're going, and then let's rock, and then let's rock makes me think of the electrical pole.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I have a sneaking suspicion that they're probably going to go to this place within the next episode or two, and it's not going to turn out well for anybody that goes. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
I'm genuinely scared for whoever ends up going
to
this place.
We're approaching one of the big episodes, I think.
Oh,
with everybody converging on this place and shit going down.
Well, and I feel like, you know, them talking about how this season is like an 18-hour movie, you know, and you kind of saw it with episode 6 or 7, felt like the end of Act 1. I feel like we're coming up to, you know, episode 12, and it feels like we're kind of getting near the end of what would be Act 2 of, like, everybody, all the characters, all plot lines are starting to come together and get kind of now all in one kind of linear progression move towards the very end.
Agreed. That whole scene ends so weirdly, though, because it's so, you're just like, huh.
Yeah.
I'm like watching every second of it and pouring over their words. And then like new young cop Jesse comes to the door. Hey, you want to see my car? Which is like, which was pointed out to me. That was kind of like, that's what all this is about, is getting back to that just innocence of like that part of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Those people are just like, I just want to show you my father figure, this new car I got. I'm proud of it. This sort of vague, naive sweetness of Twin Peaks. It's like, that's what they're literally fighting for, is goofy fuckers like Jesse and his new car. Then, of course, we get to the big scene of this, the big, like, you know, mythology scene with them going to with Cole and Tammy and Diane and Bill Hastings and I forget the detective Mackey, I think.
Mackley.
Going to the spot of that Hastings told them about, where he saw Major Briggs's head going off, and this neatest three-person perspective thing that Lynch does here, where we see the scene from Cole's point of view, we see it from Albert's point of view, and we see it from Diane's point of view, as Diane just sees, as Cole gets closer, him make gesturing in the sky. Cole sees the first the woodsman, and then the crazy vortex that some weird spherical thing is coming at him at. Not sure.
Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. And then Albert sees everything getting out of focus and Cole starting to disappear before he superheroes in and says, get the fuck out of there! I'm not going to lose you like we did David Bowie. Well, David Bowie's character, you know what I mean. And then them finding that headless body of Ruth Davenport kind of pointing into the sky.
Yeah.
With more coordinates on her arm, which has been pointed out, are Twin Peaks.
Yeah, that was like the most satisfying moment of this episode, because I saw those coordinates.
Firmly,
and there's that whole moment where they ask Gordon, like, what's going on? And he says, he gets cut off, but he basically says, you know, oh, well, there are coordinates in the Pacific Northwest. And I literally paused it and went, aha!
Yeah, right?
I knew it! Like, all the way.
Sense. It has to be the glass.
When they realize everything is all about Twin Peaks.
All the way back in, like, episode one, when Mr. C was in that diner telling him about how I'm trying to get these coordinates to get to a certain place. I'm like, it's Twin Peaks. It's going to the Black Lodge. I'm like, I swear to God, this is where this is all going.
I would bet good money that it has to be that.
Well, and it's interesting because after Hastings' head explodes and Mackley gets on the horn with to call backup, he says they're on Sycamore Street.
Yes,
which I thought, and it kind of goes back to
2240 Sycamore. Yeah,
when it goes back to in Las Vegas, the street that in the empty house that Cooper came out on,
Sycamore
was it was also Sycamore,
and as well that entrance to the Black Lodge in the Ghost Forest,
the Sycamore
in
Street
Peaks
with
Glastonbury
Grove,
surrounded by a ring of Sycamore Street.
Well, and then Dougie's house is it's all the neighborhood is all Arthurian streets, and it's over by like King Arthur's Court, Merlin's Palace, and all that. So it's all like
red
door, and it's all this weird stuff that's all starting to kind of come together.
Yeah. Someone also pointed out that if you get the still of the freeze frame, which I pulled one up for us, but it's not the best version of it because it's like kind of alternately being lit. But there's a stain on the wall that looks an awful lot like an atomic explosion.
Still
with the woodsman. Went off over here and it burned into the wall.
Yeah.
It does.
Not clear if that was intentional, but it sure looked like it to me.
And the wallpaper in the back looks like the painting. That the old woman, is it called, what were their names?
The Treadmonts.
Thank you. Yeah. The grandmother and the young child handed Laura right before Meals on Wheels, and it had a door. And that wallpaper can be seen in one little speck behind the woodsman. And I was like, good catch.
Oh, the kid with the mask.
Yeah,
it's the same wallpaper.
Hmm.
And that lady, Ruth, when she died in that, like her hand up in the air. If you look at Julie Cruz's Floating into the Night, it's a similar doll. Well, it's very similar. And then when he had the Industrial Symphony No. 1 live performance, they had a woman suspended upside down, falling nude during this. It's powerful. It's, again, falling. Someone falling through space and time.
Huh.
Reoccurring. Like, sounds
even
like
in this season.
Yeah.
Met the Major Briggs, got sucked up into like a vortex, like falling, that same thing.
Yeah, presumably Ruth went there with Bill Hastings.
Yeah.
So since they were having an affair together anyway, and she did not survive the encounter. And after this, neither did Bill, who,
this
shit just blew his mind, you know?
It went back and he was eliminated as well.
I love Mackley calling for backup and Diane just going, there's no backup for this.
that's understatement.
And then afterwards, them going back to the office, Cole's hand shaking like he describes like a cat on a tin roof.
Yeah.
Mm. And weird moment where Albert says, maybe we should not have coffee, and they just have coffee. There's just no, we're having coffee. That's. And then, of course, as we said earlier, with they looking at the coordinates that Albert took a picture of, and you can see Diane mouthing the coordinates, clearly trying to remember them, and then Albert giving her the, like, I see you, bitch. I see what you're doing.
And then her saying she wants to smoke, and then, you know, can you smoke in here? And then he magically says, smoke them if you got them, the first time someone said that in, 30 years?
Yeah, I know, right? okay, so moving on to Duper, as I like to call him, Dale Cooper. He is led into his boss, Bushnell Mullen's office, by Phil, who seems to be the only person in this universe who is aware of the fact that Dougie is completely incompetent. Like, he's actually figured out a strategy of leading him like a carrot with a horse of coffee, like leading him into the office. Just the easiest way to do it. It is still kind of funny and frustrating that no one else seems to clue in how deeply impaired this guy is. We're like, seriously? No one's like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? No, they're like, oh, I get it. It's like Being There. Have you ever seen that movie with Peter Sellers where like he says he's obviously not there altogether there, and people are like, oh, I see what he's actually doing. Like pointing out that, man, it's everybody else who's incredibly stupid.
That's why I love that moment. Like, I think it was back in like episode 6 or 7 where Naomi Watts just finally turns to Duper and goes, Dougie, what the fuck?
She knows something's up, but
Yeah, but she's also willing to sleep with a guy who essentially is an autistic, like deeply autistic child. Dougie being praised by his boss, like, oh, you're great. Saying the problem came from a cancer in his office, a conspiracy of gangsters, corrupt cops, and duplicitous insurance agents.
Duplicitous insurance agents.
Yeah, but what was weird about that was like, because we knew Tom Sizemore's character was duplicitous for sure. But then, so I assumed he was talking about like the gangsters being the Mitchum brothers, but he's like, no, they were right. We'll still give him the check. I was like, well, wait a minute. What is he actually talking about?
I think it's probably Duncan Todd is who he's talking about.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's Tom Sizemore's character?
No, that's Mr. Winky from... Mr. Winky. Yeah.
Duncan Todd. And then Sizemore's character, what is his name?
I'm blanking on it, yeah.
Tom Sizemore.
I suspect he's not going to live for more than another episode.
And that's
he's
the thing...
He's getting dangerously close because he doesn't often... The
Dougie. No, the Mitchum brothers are going to, they who don't like him anyway, are going to go, okay, now that we love Dougie, fuck you.
And it definitely felt with this scene that this whole insurance storyline thing is about to come to a close.
Yeah.
That we're nearing the end of this.
And then, you know, they're like, oh, well, the Mitchum brothers are sending a car for you, which you're like, we all know, they're just going to kill him. We're like, fuck. And hoping that he has the mind to deliver this $30 million check, knowing he doesn't. Right. And we're like he'd just die, having no idea what would have saved him. But who saves him ultimately is Mike, the one-armed man, who sends him a vision to go buy a pie at the downstairs mall.
In a giant box.
And at first I thought, are we having a 7 moment? What is that?
Yeah, it was
a freaking pie. It was so polite. He brought a pie.
It was a reverse 7 because he basically meets him in the middle of the desert with the same kind of set. It was almost the same shot for shot. I'm like, what the hell's going on?
Right?
Well, who's to say what's in the box? Oh, my God.
We all hoped it was Gwyneth Paltrow's head. Which a lot of people pointed out that final scene seems to no question be directly like a satire of 7.
Oh, yeah.
Which
was
like ends exactly the opposite of how 7 does. You know, you're just
it's like bringing a pie to it seemed like a very 50s gesture to new neighbors and everyone loves each other.
Innocence and friendship and things like that represent cherry pie. You know?
And Jim Belushi.
Old American dream.
Yeah. Let's talk about what a comedic god Jim Belushi actually is in this episode. Because
that was so funny.
I've never liked him before at all. I was kind of like, whatever, but he just brought it. He was hilarious.
Well, I love Robert Knepper in that scene when he pulls the gun. He's just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what are you talking about?
It's like the whole, so presumably Mike also sent the dream to Bradley Mitchum to Jim Belushi, who is the prophetic dream that saves Dale Cooper's life when he was like, oh, if there's a pie in that box, then he's not our guy. He didn't do it. They're like, and that moment where he gets the check and his knees bend, he gets the check, like, $1 million.
Yeah, it's pretty good stuff.
That's so weird. Which, of course, led up to, I think, everybody's favorite moment this episode, which they tease you. You're just waiting for it. Mm-hmm. And Dougie echoing one of the Mitchum brothers by saying, as he's shoveling the cherry pie down his mouth, damn good.
Yeah, it was snappy.
With more intonation than he normally delivers lines. And Dougie delivers lines.
And his
more
jaw isn't slack.
Yeah.
And it's like he changes his whole posture for a second. You're
feeling
like, holy shit.
It reminded
me of that moment in episode 4 or 5 when he calls out Tom Sizemore in that meeting. And for just that split second becomes old Cooper again and just says he's lying. Like, it reminded me a lot of that moment.
Yeah, little flashes of old Cooper. And this definitely is the thing we all know we've been waiting for. When is he going to have pie?
Yeah.
We saw him have coffee and go, this is the thing I love. Yeah. I remember loving this. Yeah. And now with pie, Jesus Christ, I'm going to be able to take this guy anywhere. meanwhile, Candy, of course, is standing there still totally bugged out. And then the gorgeous Angela Badalamenti piano number being played in the background. Although I was kind of like, why didn't you just have Badalamenti step in and be the piano player in this scene?
Isn't that weird?
I thought it was an odd choice to have an actor do it instead of Badalamenti himself.
I thought that was strange, too. Maybe they... Yeah, I can't figure... Oh. And I like how the music was in the Las Vegas lounge piano bar. And so it's integrated into the scene more, and there was dialogue. Instead of like, okay, now it's the roadhouse. Yeah. I liked how it's like, okay, it makes sense. They're in a piano bar. They're having pie. Everyone's cheering, and there's talking. And then he's like, this kind of reminds me of something. And it kind of reminds me of Laura's theme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a little bit.
It hits that same kind of minor key at the beginning.
And this is one of the only episodes that Bad Lamente actually had music almost all the way through it.
Yeah.
Like, we've seen only bits and spurts of his score, and this episode is the first one where it's there a lot.
Again, going back to, you know, the show's more and more becoming classic Twin Peaks.
Like
this episode tonally resembled more than any other ones an episode of classic Twin Peaks.
Definitely, like with that great mix of like dark moments to funny.
It really hit that balance.
And
this one was very much the most linear, you know. And mm-hmm. I felt like you've kind of watched, other than like the brief trip to Crazy Town in episode 8, you've kind of watched this gradual arc of the episodes themselves becoming more linear and more structured as they go along.
Wonderful, wonderful Crazy Town. If it's David Lynch's Crazy Town, I'll visit anytime. Oh, yeah, and then, as if this sequence couldn't be any more charming with Dougie, like, them trying to toast, he keeps grabbing for their glass, like, no, it's your glass. And, like, they're just loving him so much. They're like, God, don't you feel like, it's like, Bill Blassie, I love that guy. The old Saturday Night Live, you know, you're like, it's Dougie Jones. Yeah. Don't you love that guy? The old woman coming up that we saw in the original
that
Mr. Jackpot's
so
episode,
wonderful.
Who's now, like, you know, wealthy, and, like, she reconnected with her son, and she's like, thank you, Mr. you're a saint.
Which is only, like, three days later,
It seems like, oh, wow, so much has changed for her. But she was kind of like a, I don't think she was homeless, but she kind of looked down.
She looked disheveled.
Yeah, she looked sad.
Yeah.
And then when she said, I hope you know what a special person you're having dinner with. Or did she say special or divine or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. But it was like, yeah.
Man, I would kill or die, though, for a close-up of that map. All we've got is a couple flashes, and we see a long shot, but not... It's just so you can't really make out details very well. I'm like, duh, somebody on set had to have taken a picture of this fucking thing.
I can't imagine they did.
Yeah, I looked everywhere.
No, he probably had no cameras. And did you hear the great story about Jim Belushi improvising?
No.
So during that scene, Jim Belushi apparently decided to ad-lib a line, and then David Lynch stopped, grabbed a magnum hose, and says, Mr. Belushi, will you please come to the principal's office?
Uh-oh.
That's pretty funny. Well, that's all I have written down for this stuff of notes that I took. And if you guys have anything else you want to add to these three episodes or what you predict is coming, then this is the time.
So one of the things I've been thinking about a lot with Dougie, and I'm strictly in the Dougie camp, and I love Dougie. I'd be fine with it being Dougie till the end of time because I think Dougie's, we are Dougie, hashtag.
Yeah.
Kind of like we're talking about him being kind of the being there character, the Chauncey Gardner, that sort of thing. In a way, it's kind of like a play. And a lot of the show is a joke. It's a meta play on the show itself, about TV, about modern culture, sure. It's also, to me, like a joke on what Agent Cooper was in the original series. He was this amazing detective, and now he's just kind of slifing through, and he's still this amazing detective.
Yeah.
He does nothing, and he's still better than anybody else. I think it's kind of a joke on that. How long that goes and people tolerate it is one thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's a really funny, just like he's still, even just with his look of glances, he's still that amazing person deep inside.
Yeah.
And I do stand by the theory that they're going to merge, because I think that makes the most sense at this point. They're going to become, because they both represent something of each, and they're going to kind of come together and be one goop.
I agree.
Yeah, I feel like this episode, episode 11, definitely started to kind of sow the seeds for the direction that we're kind of going as we start to approach the end game of all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're starting to see all of these, you know, seemingly disparate storylines, you know, come together. I mean, we've been seeing in South Dakota everything kind of come to a head there. But in Vegas, everything start to come to a head. And then now with the reveal of the coordinates, you know, and all that, it's becoming very, very clear that very, very soon we're going to have a lot of these other characters who haven't been in Twin Peaks this season all be going back there, and that this is where this is all going to end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's exciting, you know, and also kind of terrifying at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
And also has that sort of like, no, I don't want it to end.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, don't.
But it has to,
moment.
Though. But
that's the thing is, it's episode by episode, it's gaining more and more momentum.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of feel that. And this does very much feel like probably the next episode is going to be our, like, end of act two.
It feels
as,
like that,
as it were. And something probably really monumental is going to happen.
I'm expecting
the next
one to be big. Yeah.
Yeah,
to be another three or eight again.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm curious about that Black Fire. And since I'm from Washington, the first thing I thought of was like Mount St. Helens or Mount Rainier blowing.
Right.
Or some old ancient... But it's not electricity.
Well, you might be onto something. You might be onto something because in the book, they talk about how the Twin Peaks were both, back in the day, they used to be active volcanoes. And then mm-hmm. they became dormant. They lay dormant for thousands of years. So maybe you're getting onto something because
they could just be all or as I like to call reunion. Them
mountain fountains.
Yeah, big reunion at the R&R Diner, and if Mount Rainier wants to go, it could just game yeah. over for everybody. Yeah. So it's just solved.
That would be
it's
interesting if like it the climactic is like to one of the peaks turning into an active volcano and destroying Twin Peaks.
It'd be very end of Lost.
Everyone's thinking, you know, if Mount Rainier goes, game over.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter anymore, you know, how much your rent is and your traffic jam. If that fucker goes.
Yeah.
Because Mount St. Helens was pretty dramatic.
I lived in Virginia, and we had ash falling in Virginia from the Mount St. Helens when that blew. I remember we were having a crab feast outside, which is something we do in Virginia, and on picnic tables and hammers and all that. And and then I was like, what the fuck? And it was like just black ash falling out of the sky.
It was
really
Jesus. Weird. I thought it was the end of the world.
They've said that if Yellowstone goes, that could very well cause the equivalent of a nuclear winter.
Could trigger the other.
Yeah,
and then it's game over.
Yellowstone is essentially a super volcano.
Yeah,
you know, like I think they said something like 500 times bigger than Mount St. Helens if it blew, which would be like, we'd be kind of fucked. And there's literally nothing we can do about that. Like,
oh no,
where are the James Bond villains who like don't want everyone to die? You know, who are like all those guys always like I've controlled the harness the power of geothermal magnetism to cause the San Andreas Fault to break. It's like, or you could just fix Yellowstone so we don't all die.
Yeah,
it's somebody call Blofeld and appeal to his better side. You like kitties. You can't be all bad. Just saying.
It's but it's, because it's, and then another, like, I read through different theories and I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's kind of interesting. And someone said, what if Laura didn't die and it was her doppelganger that got murdered by her father, that she's sitting in a lodge safe?
Man, that would be such a huge, I don't know, that would be such a huge cop-out and a retcon. Like,
I mean,
that,
she is getting pretty dark towards the end, but at the same time, like, people who you think would know that she was a doppelganger were trying to protect her.
And that would just sort of invalidate Fire Walk With Me just as a movie in a weird way. Like, it would just sort of, like, take away all the dramatic weight that movie has.
Because the whole point of her wearing the ring was to not go to the lodge and to not be taken over. It was that the only thing she could do was be killed.
And that's kind of the interesting thing with, you know, that whole line about Laura being the one that, again, somehow in some way, that this is all going back to where it started, you know, and sooner rather than later.
So you think that little bug creature, you know, that we keep seeing on the playing card, the map, could be the bug creature that we saw climb inside the mouth in Episode 8?
Oh,
I'd be representative of that.
I definitely. Well, I think it might be that.
That's interesting.
There's also a whole thing in the book where they talk about giant flying owls.
Right.
And so part of me, like, seeing that, part of me is like,
it does look like an owl.
Yeah, I'm wondering. I'm like, are you guys going to go there and have, like, a huge fucking lost owl flying, you know, in the sky?
I suppose it's as possible as anything.
Yeah, it could happen, honestly.
It's funny we're this far into it and still, like, every theory we have how this is going to wrap up are all pure speculation.
Yeah.
There's we're not even close to enough to go on to feel like we know where this is all going for sure. And that's one of the things that makes the show as great as it is. Yes, it's abstract and bizarre, but you can follow it, and nothing is so abstract that you're like, okay, now I have no idea what's going on at all, but yet it's just abstract enough to keep you off your on your toes and off your footing. So you're like, we are. What the fuck is going to happen?
Yeah.
Everything is a surprise.
And I've said this before, and how awesome is it? We're now getting to episode 12.
Yeah.
Not a single spoiler.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's tight.
Not one. Oh,
I've seen one thing that I'll tell you about offline.
Okay.
Yeah, don't
but otherwise,
it's not really it's not a spoiler. It just kind of is an interesting
it's
thing.
It's so tight. It's so tight. So controlled. That's in this day and age, really impressive.
Yeah.
I love it.
Talking to the guy we did the interview with, he was like, honestly, nobody wants to spoil anything on that set.
Yeah.
They all love this. So they all love David Lynch. Like, he's apparently just about as sweet a guy as you could imagine. He's not at all like you would think a guy who makes movies like David Lynch is like. You'd think he'd be very cold and very standoffish and very like oh, almost a guy who doesn't even refuses to speak to people but tells his assistant what to say.
He's very
like kind of crazy.
50s, he's a Boy Scout.
He's 50s dad.
Yeah, yeah, he's 50s dad because
he's J.R. Bob Dobbs.
Met him a couple times. Met him a couple times. He came to Cornish and spoke to an audience of only 10 people. This was like right after like Blue Velvet, right before Twin Peaks started.
Yeah.
And he's very, very, yeah, Bob Dobbs. He's very 50s guy, and he's very polite. Like, it reminds me of my parents. Very 50s, very polite, morals, very Boy Scout. And it's, and I was impressed. I was like, this guy's cool.
Yeah, everybody seems to love him who works with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, everybody constantly comes back, so you're like, wow, he must be one of the great, like... And the guy I talked to was like, he literally was like, showed him everything he wanted him to do with his arms and legs. He was like, here's what you're moving like this. Like, he put his arms around him and it was like moving his arms and legs. And it's like, wow, that's crazy. And would greet him in the hallway when he saw him by name and stuff afterwards. You're like, oh, that's so sweet.
And I also like to think this is going to be it because I don't think you could do this again because one, so many people have died.
Yeah.
And two, it's such a singular thing that, you know, we weren't expecting it. I think he is the kind of person who wouldn't want to do that again. He's like, we did this. He has a very, he apparently has a very clear vision. And I can feel it wrapping up. I have no idea how, but I can see it wrapping up in 6 episodes, 7 episodes. Sure, why not?
Yeah, well, and Mark Frost has kind of basically alluded that this is probably going to be it.
He also said, but maybe not.
Well, that's the thing. It's like
a movie finale.
Well, that's the thing is he's doing the book after this. It's going to be kind of like the wrap-up book.
Final dossier.
But everything I've kind of been hearing kind of leads me to believe, if for no other reason than the fact that they've spent like 5 years just making this season, that they're not ruling out the possibility of doing more after this, but they're just kind of, for now, assuming this is probably going to be it.
I mean, I would love if they were just like, this wraps up what was happening in Twin Peaks, but there are other Blue Rose things.
Oh, that would be great.
There are other things that go on that are bizarre and multidimensional. There are other dangers out there, you know, and deal with those. But I'm the guy who just wants this world to never end.
Do you think it's going to have a nice 50s ending, kind of like Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart? Like, it's still dark and bittersweet, but they did give them two... happy ending.
If Coop is fully recovered and then is wearing a snakeskin jacket and starts singing all this, I will be so happy.
I don't know. I'm very back and forth on that. I mean, part of me is leaning towards that it might end like that in a very idealized fashion because, again, going back to stuff that Mark Frost is talking about from like way early on when they announced this, you know, he said that like their big intention with this is making sure that that audiences got like a very satisfying conclusion with this. That's possible, but again, at this point, I don't know. Anything is on the table.
Possible. Yeah, absolutely anything. So anybody have any last stuff before we finish up?
No.
All right, so we will be back presuming schedules don't go crazy again, in another 2 weeks for episodes 12 and 13, which I suspect will be a lot of, oh my God, moments in it, as we're careening towards the big conclusion with episode 18. Presuming they don't announce it, episode 17. By the way, it's actually 25 episodes. Which would be, I'd be like, hooray!
Yay!
So it's like we're addicted like Sparkle.
Yeah, this is Twin Peaks is our Sparkle.
Yeah.
Don't they know about Sparkle Motion?
Oh, I doubt your commitment.
Yeah.